You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Auto insurance can all seem the same until it comes time to use it. So don't get stuck paying more for less coverage. Switch to USAA Auto Insurance and you could start saving money in no time. Get a quote today. Restrictions apply. USAA.
Spring, is that you? Warmer temps mean new Allbirds styles. Meet the Superlight Collection, the lightest ever shoes from Allbirds, now in fresh colors. These must-have travel shoes have a lighter-than-air feel and barely their fit that made them the most packable shoes ever. That means more comfort and less baggage. Try the Superlight Tree Runner with a cushy foam midsole and breathable eucalyptus fiber upper. Plus, they're comfy right out of the box. So, what can you do in a Superlight shoe? What can't you do is the better question. And because they're super packable, the real question is, where are you taking them? Experience how Allbirds redefines comfort. Visit Allbirds.com and use code SUPER24 for a free pair of socks with a purchase of $48 or more. That's Allbirds.com, code SUPER24.
Hundreds of years ago, long before Google Maps, it was common to see maps adorned with fantastic creatures and mythical monsters. But over time, that practice died out. If you're like me, you probably thought those creatures were doodles to fill in the vast emptiness of the seas. Well, I've been disabused of that notion by the researcher Chet Van Duzer. And today, we'll be talking about sea monsters on medieval maps on Monster Talk.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith, and today we're going to learn about the medieval practice of adorning maps with monsters. But first, I want to tell you about an upcoming event in Atlanta that might be of interest to you. For the fifth year in a row, the Metcalf Memorial Star Party is being held the Thursday night before DragonCon. This is a fundraiser to fight cancer and will feature speakers Phil Plait, Pamela Gay, and Nicole Gigliucci. There will be music. There will be food. And barring unforeseen circumstances, there will be me. I'm not on the official venue, but I'm very accessible if you want to say howdy. Go to AtlantaStarParty.com to learn more and sign up. It's a good cause, and every year has been a treat. Sometimes you even get to see stars. Now let's get to some
Monster Talk.
So today we're talking with Chet Van Duzer, a writer and researcher and currently an invited research scholar at the John Carter Brown Library in Rhode Island. Chet has published extensively on medieval maps and is the author of what's probably the definitive book on medieval map monsters, which is titled Sea Monsters on Medieval and Renaissance Maps. So, Chet, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Blake.
I recently had the opportunity to hear Chet lecture at the Georgia Aquarium, and it was great, and he's graciously agreed to do our show here. So tell us about your book, because I think that's probably how I got interested in this topic. I mean, that's not true, by the way. I actually have always been interested in map monsters. I didn't realize how ignorant I was, though. So let's talk about your book.
Well, it's a fun topic, and the book is the first in-depth discussion of sea monsters on maps, and it covers the period from the 10th century, which is the date of the earliest surviving maps that have sea monsters, to the beginning of the 17th century, when sea monsters on maps started to decline, and it's heavily illustrated in color with, you know, good details of the monsters on the map, so you can get up close and personal with them. When I first got interested in the subject, I was surprised to learn that there was no good study of sea monsters on maps, as they're one of the most visually engaging and characteristic elements of medieval maps. And as it turns out, the monsters on maps can also reveal a lot about the sources that the cartographers were using. And that's something I devote a lot of space to in the book. So I felt very lucky that no one had treated this topic before in much detail.
Yeah, I have to say, it was startling to me how much information you were able to deliver on this topic. I think, and I don't know if this is how most people view this, but I think prior to actually attending your lecture, I had always assumed that the monsters on maps were not doodles per se, but just the works of imagination of the cartographer. Like they had all this empty space out in the water and they would just fill it with pictures. But that's not at all what this is about.
Yeah, and in fact, that was one of the most interesting results of my study, because as you say, the monsters that you see on these maps do look like pure whimsy. They look like something that the cartographer just pulled out of the air. But what I found is that in many cases, the cartographers took their sea monsters from the most authoritative works that were available to them, such as illustrated medieval encyclopedias. And many of the creatures in these works are not real. Many of the creatures in these encyclopedias are not real. But the point is that the cartographers were seeking out and using the best sources available to them, and they were portraying creatures that they thought were real, that they thought they had good authority for. So they weren't, in general, they weren't just making them up. There are exceptions to that, but in general, they were doing their best to portray creatures that they thought were real.
Would you say most of the creatures on these maps are creatures of legend?
Because the creatures in these illustrated encyclopedias, for example, aren't real, the question arises as to how they came to be portrayed in these encyclopedias. And many of the specific creatures in these sources are based on legend. But it's a difficult line to draw and to know what the sources of these creatures were. Unfortunately, we don't have much information on that subject.
Right. But you, in your talk, you did talk about extant myth that there were analogies between land creatures and sea creatures. Can you explore that just a little bit for our listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So there was a theory that goes back to classical antiquity, and it's repeated by medieval authors. And in fact, I think I recall seeing it in a book from the 17th century. The theory states that for every land creature, there is a corresponding sea creature. And so you can see Roman mosaics, for example, that have a leopard with a fishy tail or a goat with a fishy tail. So this theory was a very prolific generator of sea monsters. And that type of sea monster is something that you see, that category of sea monster is something that you see on a lot of medieval and Renaissance maps.
Yeah, the sea hare.
Yes.
Obviously, this is an audio presentation, but if you get the book, and you should, it does have this astonishing array of – it's just amazing the things that people hypothesize might be out in the ocean.
Yeah.
And it seemed ridiculous to me because there's just so many strange creatures in the sea compared to what's on land. But then the more I thought about it, I realized I am slowly turning into a giant jellyfish. So maybe there's something to it. I probably just need to hit the gym. So do you think the people who created the maps really expected to see these animals out in the ocean?
Well, yes, they found these creatures in books, and as far as they knew, the books were by respected authors like Thomas of Cantimpré, who made this encyclopedia in the Middle Ages, and some of the manuscripts of the work are illustrated. And it seems likely that at least in some cases, the creatures on maps come from Thomas of Cantimpré's encyclopedia. So I'm not sure that people looking at the maps were thinking about it in those terms, like if they were thinking about making a voyage. But when they saw those creatures on maps, they believed that, and particularly if they were educated and were familiar with these encyclopedias, they would recognize some of these creatures as creatures whose existence was attested to in these authoritative works. So, yes, I think people looking at the maps would think that if they sailed there, they would see these creatures.
I've done a lot of research on various historical claims and monsters. But I've never tried to do that from pictures, you know. So usually with a literary source or a written story, I can use all sorts of indexes to look things up. How do you do this kind of research? How do you track back the monsters on the map to their literary sources?
Or iconographic sources.
Or iconographic sources. Yeah. I mean, what's the literal library work like? What's the research like?
Well, it is challenging. It's a good question. So, for example, Johann Schoner, a German mathematician and geographer and astrologer, created a terrestrial globe in 1515. And it has depictions of a number of sea monsters on it. And I was very interested to find out where those monsters came from. And what I started doing was looking at illustrated books that were published, illustrated books that had sections about animals that were published before the globe was made. I wish I could say that I had some very clever technique for finding the source, but in the end, it was just a lot of hours in the library looking at every illustrated book I could get my hands on. And eventually found an illustrated encyclopedia, which was first published in 1491 in Germany, called the Hortus Sanitatis, or Garden of Health. And it has a section on sea creatures. Once I saw it, I knew immediately that those sea creatures were taken from that book. They were copied from that book. And this was confirmed when I saw the same cartographer, Johann Schoner, his manuscript globe from 1520, which has very similar images of sea monsters on it, but it also has texts with them. And I guess there wasn't room for texts on the 1515 globe, but on the 1520 globe, it's much larger. There's room for texts, and those texts come from that encyclopedia. So that really confirmed in the clearest possible way that that encyclopedia was the source. And then in Gerard Mercator's famous world map of 1569, most of us have heard of the Mercator projection, and we've heard of that because of this map. It has about a dozen sea monsters on it. And again, just by doing a lot of library research, I found that most of those sea monsters were taken from a book about sea creatures published by Pierre Ballon about a dozen years before Mercator made his map.
Are the monsters at the top of the map larger than the monsters in the middle? Oh, those Mercator jokes.
Yes, that's right. Well, actually, you know, what's interesting about the sea monsters on that map is if you compare them with the ones in the book, they're all reversed left to right. And that was because if you're engraving words on a printing plate, for example, you have to engrave them backwards so that when you print them, they come out correct. But what happened in this case is that the engraver looked at these sea monsters and thought, well, it doesn't matter if they're reversed left to right, and it's easier for me if I just copy them directly.
So, yeah, and they're great copies. That's the other thing that really impressed me. I mean,
yeah,
these guys didn't – it's not original material, but they did a fantastic job of copying. It's great.
Yes. Yeah, and it's actually interesting that they did such a careful job. It shows that they really did care about getting the details right, even when they were copying something like a seahorse. That, you know, for us, it's obvious that it doesn't exist.
Yeah, so when you're doing the actual research, so it sounds like you still deal with some of the same issues. So you have a suspicion that this is the source for this this written thing is the source for the creature in this map, and then you have to see, does it match up in description, and is it chronologically possible that this is the source? Would the book have been available in the area at the time, I assume, would also be a question.
That is also a question, and then some of the works in question were not printed. So they were manuscript books that were copied by hand and in some cases illustrated by hand. And that gets even more difficult to try and determine, were manuscripts of that work available in that area? Were they available in that area at that time? And those questions are often very, very difficult to answer.
Where does this map go? Where is it published? And what's it like in the workshop of someone putting this together? What kind of sources are they bringing together? What kind of tools are they using?
As far as the audiences of the map, that's a good question. And there's a difference between in that regard between a manuscript map and a printed map. So a manuscript map would typically is painted by hand. The wording is done by hand, and it would typically be done on parchment. And because it was all by hand, because it was on parchment, it was a very labor-intensive process. And particularly if the map was elaborately decorated with, for instance, descriptive text or images of cities or images of sea monsters, it would be quite expensive. And so the audience in that case would be a very elite audience and a rich audience, frankly. The advent of printing sort of democratized maps to a large extent. They didn't become something that everyone can afford, certainly, but they opened up cartography to a much wider audience. And as far as what was going on in the workshop, that's a question I like to think about a lot. I like it when I can analyze a map and try and understand what was happening in the workshop. And so one example that's particularly interesting in that regard is a map by Martin Waldseemüller, who was working in a little town called Saint-Dié, which is now in eastern France. And I'm thinking specifically of his world map of 1516 called the Carta Marina, which is on permanent display at the Library of Congress. And that map was the result of a very intense research by the cartographer. What he did is he copied the outlines of the land, it's a world map, so he copied the outlines of basically all the lands from one map. But that map had very little in the way of interior detail. It didn't have much in the way of rivers or mountains or descriptive texts about the people who live in region X and so on. And so what he did is once he'd drawn those outlines, he did research in travel narratives, books of cosmography and so forth, and assembled this tremendous amount of information, which he then added to the map. And I'm not sure that that process is entirely typical, but it does show that cartographers were doing research. With the case of sea monsters, we know that the cartographers were doing research into what sea monsters should I portray on my map. Well, they went looking in recent books about animals and sea creatures to try and find the most authoritative information, which is why Gerard Mercator was using that book published 12 years before. So a cartographic workshop in the Middle Ages and Renaissance was active in terms of research, certainly.
That is really neat. I think it's really simple now to take a look and go, oh, that's interesting. Isn't that pretty? Those are strange looking creatures, but not really give a lot of deep thought into how much work each one of these maps represents.
That's right.
But it's actually, it's not like they can just go look at a map and then make a copy of it. I mean, it's much more than that, it seems to me, especially, and we're just talking about the monster part, but I mean, knowing the names of the cities, knowing what the regions topography was supposed to be like. Mm-hmm. No, these aren't entirely, I mean, again, they're not really designed to take you specifically on a ship and take you from one place to the other. But so how are they different from the navigational maps of the time?
It's important to talk about the different purposes of maps. And there's two large categories of medieval maps. One is called mappae mundi. This singular is mappa mundi, the plural mappae mundi, which just means world map, basically. And they were not intended to be tools for travel at all. Instead, they were intended for study or display. And the vast majority of them are small and schematic and really only indicate the relative positions of Europe, Africa, and Asia. There are larger and more elaborate examples that show mountain ranges and rivers, but even those were intended for study rather than to be taken on a trip. So the whole genre of Mapamundi is not oriented towards travel at all. It's oriented towards study and display.
And the center of the world and the orientation of the directions is different.
Yes. So usually, not always, but usually, let's just say a lot of these maps are centered on Jerusalem. And most of them are oriented with east at the top. So east with the holy direction, the direction where the sun rises, where paradise was thought to be located. So yes, they're distinctive in that way too. The other main category of medieval maps are nautical charts, which are sometimes called Portolan charts. And they're very different. They were designed as practical tools for navigation to guide sea captains. The emphasis is on coastal features, and they have a network of what are called rum lines, these sets of lines that radiate out from points on the chart. And those points form a circle, and the exact function of rum lines is not entirely clear, but they certainly had something to do with a ship finding its way from one point to another.
Are you saying rum or run?
Rum, R-H-U-M-B.
Oh. I thought, well, if they go circular and there's a bunch of sailors, I was in the Navy, I know what that means.
Yes.
I got it. Okay, sorry. Thank you.
It's all right. And these were, in their essence, they were practical tools for navigation. The ones that have survived down to modern times were not taken to sea. We don't have a single medieval nautical chart that has come down to us that was one that was taken to sea, at least not that we can tell. And the reason for that is twofold. First, the ones that were taken to sea saw hard usage. They were exposed to very humid sea air all the time. They were used on the captain's table on the ship. And, it's easy to imagine that after time they were just worn out from service and were disposed of. The ones that have come down to us are more elaborately decorated examples. So the ones that were used on ship would have been very workmanlike. They would have shown the coastlines accurately. They have the coastal place names written along the coast, and they have this network of rum lines. But they would have very little in the way of interior detail, and they would have very little in the way of decoration. But there were other types of nautical charts, more elaborately decorated examples that would have these painted images of cities. They would have descriptive texts about the people who lived in a certain region. They would have images of kings, and they could have images of sea monsters as well. And these were very expensive indeed. They were things that would have been owned by a prince, for example, or a king. And they were more like a Mapamundi in that they were intended for display. It was more along the lines of conspicuous consumption and also study. So those are the two main types of medieval maps, Mapamundi and nautical charts. And their intended functions are very different.
Do you study the history of cartography itself?
I do, yeah.
It seems like it's a mixture of art and math. And geometry, which is part of math, I guess. It's a lot of things. But I know it got really good later. I mean, I've looked at the Lewis and Clark maps, which astonished me. And so I guess there had to be some technology improvements to get really, really accurate maps. But that was also different because that was kind of a land map. And you could stand there and use sighting tools. Mm-hmm. So how did that work? I guess it's just a different thing, but I was wondering, like, how did that advance through the medieval ages? Because by the time you get to the Renaissance, the maps start to look a lot more familiar to me.
Yes.
So what caused those improvements? I guess is my long, long, long question.
Well, the nautical charts were practical tools for navigation in their that was their basis. There are more elaborately decorated examples, but even the elaborately decorated ones have that skeleton of functionality. And those were the data came from sailors and sea captains. And we don't know, we don't have any documentation about that, that transfer of information from sea captains to cartographers, whether the cartographers made a habit of interviewing sea captains when they came into port, whether the sea captains were making sketch maps as they sailed and then later gave those to cartographers.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose, it kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever, crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon slash spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Unfortunately, we really don't have much information about that process. But one important advance in cartography was the rediscovery of Ptolemy's geography. And Ptolemy was a Greek living in Alexandria, Egypt, in the 2nd century AD. And he wrote this book called The Geography, sometimes titled Cosmography. And the book is a set of instructions on how to make maps, together with an enormously long list of 8,000 place names with their latitudes and longitudes. And when Ptolemy's geography was just barely, there's a few citations of it in medieval records, but very, very little. It basically was largely unknown in the Middle Ages. And then was rediscovered in Byzantium in about 1300 and then made its way to Italy and from Italy spread across Europe. And one thing that was very exciting about Ptolemy's geography in the early Renaissance was that it portrayed space by latitude and longitude. And that's the way modern maps are made, and to us it seems very obvious. But that systematic way for representing space, and systematic and mathematical way for representing space, was very exciting in the early Renaissance. And that was certainly an influence that helped cartography move forward tremendously.
Yeah, it's it always amazes me how that when someone clever makes an innovation that's really, really good, it always seems obvious in retrospect.
Yeah, that's right.
And it just picks up and, well, how to come, why didn't they know that, you know?
That's right.
So let's get back to monsters a little bit. That's ostensibly what this show is about.
Sure.
So we've got sea monsters.
Yes.
And that includes sea serpents and sirens and whales and great fish, Leviathan.
Uh-huh.
on the sirens, I noticed that that there's sometimes what looks to me like a sea, a mermaid, excuse me, and sometimes it's a siren. Are those labeled somewhere? I saw in your lecture, I was trying to figure out how you're discerning what the difference is.
Well, yeah, that's a tough question. I don't know of a good way to really distinguish between what's a siren and what's a mermaid, unless. If the creature is, for example, singing, I mean, that plays in with the classic mythology of the siren.
Boom, it's a siren, right, yeah.
Yeah. But in terms of distinguishing from their appearance, I don't have a good way to do that. I mean, you have ones with one tail and ones with two tails.
Yes, why is that? I noticed that. I didn't know what that was supposed to represent. If that was supposed to show that she had fish legs, you know, or if it was supposed to be motion. I was really unclear on that. Yeah.
Unfortunately, despite all my studies, I haven't become any more clear on that. The one map I showed in my talk had sirens, three different types of sirens. One half woman, half fish, one half woman, half horse. And I'm trying to remember what the other one. Oh, half woman, half bird. So there certainly are different types, but it's a thorny subject trying to distinguish between sirens and mermaids.
Yeah, I would assume the half woman, half bird is a harpy.
Yes. Even then, so Homer, the sirens in Homer were half woman, half bird.
You know, it doesn't really make any difference if I speculate, but I'm it probably isn't motion. I kept thinking about it. It probably is supposed to be that they're half human, so they have two legs. But they, since they're half fish, they have fish legs. So they're, I don't know. It's a really interesting question. It would be cool if you could find a key to solve that mystery.
It would indeed, and I'll keep my eyes peeled.
So, what about on land? Do you see a lot of land monsters? I was thinking specifically of the sort of cynocephalic creatures we've talked about on the show before, which are dog-headed creatures like St. Christopher. And then there's this other one. I can't think of its name, but it's a monster who is headless but has a face on its chest and belly.
Yeah, the blemmy eye.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Sure.
That's supposed to be my job, and I failed. So.
Yes, those certainly do appear on maps. I mean, they weren't the focus of this book, but inevitably, when I was looking for sea monsters, I came across land monsters as well, and there are many on different medieval maps. So the largest surviving medieval mapamundi is called the Hereford map, and it's on permanent display in the Hereford Cathedral in England. And it has a very, very rich array of land monsters, and particularly along the southern edge of Africa, it has a strip of many different humanoid monsters, such as the blemmy eye. So they certainly are found on maps. And again, it's a sort of traditional cast of characters, the land monsters, and particularly these humanoid the so-called Plinian races or monstrous races. And it's a traditional cast of characters, and they come from books just like the sea monsters.
Do you anticipate a follow-up volume, Land Monsters on Medieval and Renaissance Maps?
It's tempting. I mean, the sea monsters were particularly appealing just because almost nothing had been written about them. So it was a wide open field. There have been articles and books that touch on that discuss the land monsters on maps, but it still is tempting. It still is tempting to consider not all, but to do a very broad address broadly
a survey.
A survey, yes, exactly.
It would be nice because this your book here on sea monsters really brings together a lot of amazing imagery, a lot of which I hadn't seen before. Take a look at this and consider buying a copy. It'll make you look smart.
And the other thing about it is it's a lot of fun. I mean,
yeah, it really is.
There's a scholarly aspect to it. It was very, for me, I really enjoyed. So when I was able to figure out what the source of the sea monsters on a particular map was, I gained some insight into, you know, what was on the cartographer's bookshelf, which I always enjoy. And so there's that scholarly aspect to it. But at the same time, they're just a lot of fun. And, you know, when I give talks about sea monsters, everyone goes away with a smile. It's just a really engaging topic.
It is. And I found one particular story that you told about a recurring image that was about the image of a whale or a giant fish with a fire on its back. Would you talk about how that story develops?
Yes. Well, it first appears in a book called The Physiologus, which goes back to classical antiquity. And we don't know how it ended up in that book. And this book is a collection of tales, mostly about animals, but there are some about stones and plants that have powers as well. But the one about the whale, and all of these stories have a moral to them, a moral lesson. And the one about the whale says that that the whale is so large that it's often mistaken for an island. And so sailors are sailing along in their ship and they see what they think is an island. And so they stop on it and they fix a line to it. And then they light a fire to cook food. And the whale is so enormous that, you know, maybe it didn't feel these people standing on his back, but it does feel the heat of the fire. And when it feels the heat of the fire, it dives down into the ocean, goes way down deep, carrying with it the sailors, the ship, and everything. And the moral lesson of that story, according to Physiologus, is that if you put your faith in the devil, you'll be carried to hell. And that story was very influential. It was very often repeated in later books about animals, particularly medieval bestiaries, medieval books of animals. And the story, one iteration of the story found its way into the life of Saint Brendan, who was an Irish saint, and I believe it was the 7th century, who was said to have made a long voyage on the Atlantic, and he found many miraculous or at least wondrous islands. And one of those islands was actually a whale. And so that the story made its way into St. Brendan's, the story of his travels. And from that source, it made its way onto some maps. So I think the earliest map that has an image of St. Brendan and the whale on it is the Piri Reis map of 1513. And Piri Reis was a Turkish admiral. And he says he made his map based on his study of 20 other maps, including both European maps and Islamic maps. And on that map, there's an image of two fellows on the back of this enormous fish. And they've lit a fire. And we know what's going to happen next. The text there explains the story. But it's just before that moment when the whale dives under the surface.
It's the perfect point, because if you did it any later, there would be, you know, just ripples. And if you did it any sooner, you wouldn't know what was happening, right? So
exactly. Yeah. the crucial moment.
But it gets more complicated as the imagery, as the story, like as maps progress, that imagery gets more complex.
Well, yes. And there's more, I guess you could say, attention to detail, because in the there's a Physiologus version of the story where they stop on the whale island and light a fire to cook food. But I think in the Brendan version, they're lighting the fire as a preparation towards performing mass on the back of the whale. And there's one map from 1621 that shows that scene of this elaborate ceremony, the mass being performed on
that was
the
my
back
favorite.
Of this whale.
That was my favorite. That was terrific. the table with the candles and everything. Yeah. It was really quite elaborate.
Yeah, good thing they had all that stuff.
Well, it's like we've just been waiting to find an island because I've got all this stuff ready to go. It is quite funny to me. So I assume it's okay to reproduce that image in our show notes. The copyright may have expired, right? So
yeah, it's out of copyright. That's right.
So that was great. And the reason I thought that was particularly poignant is because a recurring theme on this show is that there will be some legend that we encounter in monster lore, which gets elaborated on without anyone going back to the source material to find out whether it was factual or not. Mm-hmm. And it's really a mechanism that extends way beyond cryptozoology and just into folklore in general. Mm-hmm. So we always talk about how people are a storytelling creature, and those stories are not static.
Right.
But they do carry themes and carry elements forward. So
absolutely. Yeah.
It was really relevant to this show. So why did the monsters die out on these maps as Western culture approached modernity?
Yes, well, on old maps, it's common to see representations of both sea monsters and ships. And if you think about it, there's actually a tension between these two types of images. Sea monsters indicate the dangers of the ocean, while images of ships proclaim the ability of humans to navigate those waters. So a lot of old maps have both images of sea monsters and ships, and those two images indicate opposite thoughts about the ocean, really. But in the middle of the 16th century, a number of cartographers started portraying sea monsters that were, in fact, simply imagined and invented by the cartographer. They assembled sea monsters. For instance, there's one with the head of an elephant and the body of a bird and these big spikes sticking out of its back. And there's no scientific source that talks about a creature of that type. And at this point, sea monsters began to take on a purely decorative function, rather than showing the creatures that were believed to inhabit the ocean. And as sea creatures, as the sea creatures on maps took on that purely decorative function, I think that was a step towards the dying out of sea monsters on maps. At the same time, as navigational technology improved and people became more confident about navigating the ocean, images of ships became more common on maps, particularly in the 17th century. And those ships are sort of the opposite, in a way, of images of sea monsters. So the increase of ships was going hand in hand with the decrease of sea monsters on maps. And as nautical charts became more and more accurate and more scientific in nature, the perceived desirability of decoration decreased, and first sea monsters and then also images of ships became less and less common on maps.
And I noticed that the ships themselves also became more detailed.
That's certainly true, yeah.
In the drawings that you showed.
Yeah.
But one thing that really stuck out was the earlier maps showed whales as a kind of monstrous creature, an unknown creature. And then as time passed and the technology being used to build these maps changed, the whales changed to be more realistic. Can you talk a little bit about that arc of the whale as monster to the whale as, resource?
Yes, exactly. The earliest, there are whales on early maps. And although the creature that swallowed Jonah, it's not clearly identified in the Bible, it's often identified with a whale. So we have an image of the creature that swallowed Jonah on very early medieval maps. The earliest map that has an image of whaling is from 1413 by a cartographer named Mejia de Villadestes. And on that map, this is an image of a whale near a ship, and it's clear that the people are trying to do something to the whale. And there's a long text that is a curious combination of myth and practical matters. So the first half of the text talks about this myth of sailors seeing what they think is an island and landing on it and then finding out that it's actually a whale. So that's the first half of the text. The second half of the text talks about practical uses for the skin of a whale. So a strange combination of myth and reality. And moving further along that scale, and one of the things that I discuss right at the end of the book is an early 17th century map made in 1625 by Thomas Edge. And it's a map of Greenland. And around the edges of the maps there's vignettes of the Arctic whale fishery that show all the stages of the process of killing and processing and catching them. And so there's an image of how to harpoon.
I would suspect that's something you would probably want a more detailed manual before you execute.
Yes. Yeah, more than just a few pictures before you got into that. Yeah, absolutely. But at that point, and again, this is one map. This is not – I don't mean to suggest that all maps were in lockstep with this one map. But on this map, certainly, the whale was no longer a monster. The whale was an object of economic exploitation. Not all maps were portraying the same thing at the same time, but that's certainly an indicator of the fact that ideas about sea creatures were changing at that time, and their monstrosity, we might say, was decreasing.
There are cases where people were clearly copying geographical details and artistic details from other maps. How rampant was copying back during this time, or during the medieval time, when these maps were being developed?
Well, in general, there was a lot of copying from one cartographer to another, and it has to be said that there was a different philosophy about copying in the Middle Ages and Renaissance. As far as map making in particular, it was a traditional art and science, as we discussed earlier. And new cartographers were trained in the workshops of established cartographers. And so copying was a part of the business. But in addition, more generally, there was not the same conception of intellectual property that we have today. And so there was a lot of copying. And then there's one particularly clear example of the copying of sea monsters, which is the case of the flying turtle. And in 1543, the Dutch cartographer Cornelis Anthonszoon published a new map of northern Europe that rendered all previous maps of the region obsolete. And although no copies of that first edition survive, we have copies of two later editions from 1558. And both of those editions include a really remarkable sea monster, a flying turtle, which is a creature so incongruous that it seems to be a symbol of paradox or impossibility.
Right, because I was going to say flying turtles don't really become an extant part of world culture, I think, until Gamera, right?
Right, that's exactly right. So these are maps ahead of their time. So we talked before about the fact that on a lot of these maps, the sea creatures that we see come from earlier scientific works. Well, there's no earlier scientific work that describes a flying turtle, much less one that places the creature in northern Europe. And in fact, the source of the flying turtle was that the turtle was the logo of the map's publisher. On the map, there's a cartouche that says this. The map was printed at the sign of the turtle, and there's four turtles sort of supporting this image. And so I think the artist sort of exaggerated the printer's logo into this flying turtle, put it on the map as a sort of a subtle advertisement for the printer. And so this flying turtle, which no one ever believed existed, I don't think, and which was in fact just an exaggerated version of the printer's logo, was copied by other cartographers throughout the second half of the 16th century. And so the career of the cartographic career of the flying turtle shows very clearly that in some cases, Renaissance cartographers copied sea monsters very uncritically. They saw something they liked, they copied it onto their map without making any effort to determine whether it had any basis in scientific text or in reality.
That's pretty funny. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show and talking with us. There is a question we try to ask all of our guests, which is, what's your favorite monster?
That's a fun question.
And we don't lock you in. If you come back at another time for another book, you're always, you know, I change my mind all the time, so don't feel pressured here, right?
Very good. My current favorite then on maps is a sea monster on Gerard Mercator's map of Europe from 1572, and the creature is certainly based on a whale because it's spouting, but instead of spouting from a hole on the top of its head, it's spouting from five elephant's trunks that stick up from its head. So it's a very extravagant creation, and the head, the rest of the head of the monster is that of a bird, and then the rest of the sort of below the neck is a fishy sort of serpentine body. So it's the type of monster we spoke about earlier, where the creator takes pieces from different creatures and assembles them into one. And it's just, it's so extravagant. It's so whimsical.
It's a chimerical.
It is. And it's quite captivating and even enchanting.
It's very cool. It's a good picture. I think I could probably find a copy of that and put it in our show notes.
Yeah, great.
So, and I'll put it so it's not reversed because I don't want people to know I copied it. So.
That's right.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Chet, for spending some time with Monster Talk. We really appreciate it.
Blake, it's been my great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Monster Talk.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Monster Talk. Today, you've been listening to an interview with Chet Van Duzer about his book, Sea Monsters on Medieval Maps. I'm Blake Smith, your host. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine, but the opinions of this show are those of me and my guests, and not necessarily those of Skeptic Magazine or the Skeptic Society. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys.
That you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more, and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.